I'm Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, guys.
How are ya?
How's your week going?
What's new? How was your Valentine's Day?
Aw, happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Galentine's to those who observe.
Oh, yes, we observed.
Oh, we observed Horde.
Yes.
You know what? I just think any excuse to get those little stupid Pillsbury cookies with like a little design on them is a thing to do.
Are you kidding me right now?
I am not. I saw them in your fridge.
Two boxes of them right now for girls' night. Are you kidding me?
I know, because that is what the soul needs. You know, there's a lot going on in the world, but if I can support one thing, it's going to be stupid little Pillsbury cookies.
If I can make the Pillsbury Dole Man smile at me, I've made someone smile today. You know what I mean?
And thank God it's not just me, the Pillsbury Dough Girl. So that's what they call me.
These streets.
Yeah, that's my street name.
I will throw hands with anybody who says that about my goddamn wife. So
I'm gonna get beat up. How are you guys? Is your week going better than mine? Because I had to go to the DMV 2 times in 7 days.
Yeah, that's rough.
It was like a combined total of 3 hours, and I do feel like maybe I understand a little more of what like maybe religious prophets are talking about with purgatory as a concept. I feel like perhaps I've seen the Beetlejuice afterlife waiting room.
No, it's true. The DMV definitely has a section where people go to die.
Yeah. Oh, certainly.
But it's almost like they're chained to the floor. Like everyone is moaning and groaning, but everyone's sitting in like that uncomfortable chair.
The plastic chair with the metal bars at the bottom.
And everyone's complaining, but nobody's gotten up.
Yes. And it's like they're putting your ass in jail.
Yeah. And then you go up and like sometimes it's a nice person and other times it's somebody that should have retired 10 years ago.
Oh, certainly.
And is holding on for God knows what. And they're like, you see these three cameras in front of you for your next ID picture? And you say, mm-hmm. And they say, okay, look at the bottom one.
Yeah. And they said, no. Look straight at it.
No.
Chin all the way in.
Chin down. And I'm like, okay, which one then? Which chin? Yeah.
First of all, fuck you. Second of all, do I have to take off my glasses?
Seriously.
Literally, the guy was like, well, with the reflection in the little lenses, you can't see eyes. And I was like, nobody gives a fuck about my eyes.
I love your
Everybody
eyes.
Likes these cheeks. These Midwest cheeks. That's what they're looking for.
These Midwest cheeks.
I know
cheeks.
It.
And these bangs, damn it.
I will say my last license photo, though, it looks like I was really channeling like a Karen or the girl who's like a toddler and smiling in front of a burning building.
I do love that, though.
It has chaotic energy, and this one has less chaotic energy, but I do look worse. So it's kind of a wash.
You know, it's not true.
What a time. Yeah, I hope you guys don't have to go to the DMV anytime in the next 4 years because that sucked ass.
It's not ideal, no. But if you learn anything from these experiences, it's think ahead, make an appointment.
Oh my gosh, make an appointment.
And then however long you think it's going to take, double it, and
you'll probably be fine.
You'll be in the ballpark, yeah. You'll get a good estimate there.
The first time I was there for 2 hours. It was a random ass Tuesday at 1 p.m. and the place was so fucking packed there were people lined up against the walls. It was like fucking airport rules. And then this time I was there for a little under an hour, had an appointment both times, actually got seen this time.
True.
And got to go back to work after. I was like, cool, so that's what I get to show people for the next 5 years.
Yes.
Cool.
Yep. Well, when I went, I had to change my name. And
yeah,
then
you did.
I was just like, oh, I'll just do the paperwork to like change my name. And they were like, new name, new picture. And I was like, I was not prepared for that. That really Danny's my DeVito. I wasn't looking forward to that. I did not come prepared.
I'm in a sweatshirt.
Yeah, no, my hair was like pulling some Hagrid shit. Like, I'm like, oh, man.
I love your Hagrid vibes, though, when your hair's all puffy and big.
Oh, no. I was born in the wrong decade, wrong era.
Okay, yeah. You were born to be a gamekeeper.
Hells yeah. I should not have said that.
100% of things you should not have said.
That. Well, anyway, I cannot wait. I've been on the edge of my seat, literally, waiting for this part two. Even though I know what happens, like, I know this case. I just can't wait for your diving into it.
Well, thank you. I'm very excited. So I have good news and I have bad news.
Okay.
They are the same news, in fact.
All right, so hit me with the good news.
The good news, and also the bad news, is that this is actually part two of three.
That is excellent news.
Yay!
No, I love it, because there is so much to this case.
There is so much to this case, and frankly, I was writing, and I got to 9 pages for this one before I even hit the trial, first trial.
Ooh, spoiler alert.
And in case you didn't know, the trial went for like 67 fucking days. It was 5 full months of trial. So I was like, there's no chance we're fitting that in like 2 pages.
Well, and I'll also say that in a lot of cases, the trial is usually pretty uneventful in that like you cover everything when you're explaining what happened. And right. So the trial part is like, okay, so everything we just said, they said that. And then here's what happened.
Right.
And it's usually like, I don't know.
Pretty easy.
A couple of minutes, and so it's not much, but the trial here is as juicy, if not more so,
more
than everything that you covered beforehand, because this was cinematic. This was an event. This was national news, raunchy, sexy. Like,
they literally played over an hour of phone sex in the fucking court.
Her butthole was on like an 85-inch screen.
Yeah, and she said, oh, I need to get that bleached. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. She was back to brunette by then. She was fine.
It's true. It's true. But like that's a Jodi Arias butthole.
Yeah. Yeah, right up there for a judge to see in robes and, you know, her mom to see and his mom to see.
And his like grandparents.
Yeah.
You know, the people that raised him that loved him.
Everybody on NBC, everybody on Fox, everybody on ABC.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the C's.
This was a bipartisan event. People together. This was
back when we were Americans first, damn it.
This was unity at its finest.
Unity at its finest butthole.
Thank because you. We all said, well, at least we're not her. Fuck. Yeah. So on that note,
a pod's on.
Yay.
Come get it while it's hot and ready. Well, hi, hello, howdy. Welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast about time for true crime.
You guys.
Aw. Today we are picking up our series on Jodi Arias and Travis Alexander.
Yes.
Before we hop back in, I do just want to do some trigger warnings, cover my sources, and give a little recap of where we left off. So in today's episode, we are going to get into quite a bit of mental health, more vivid details on the death, which is incredibly gory, and not a ton of sexually explicit details. Those will come more next episode, but there might be a few mentions. So if that matters to you, just know. And also, there will also be some really gory shit, I think is really the best way to put it. It's not unexplicit. So.
Yes.
And some really odd shit. And please tell me you all know that scene from True Detective. Otherwise, that's real weird. Okay. For sources, please note that in the show notes, there is a linked spot named Sources that will take you to every single fucking source I used for this series. And I am at least 2 full pages. So there is a lot.
Yeah, we go hoard.
We go hoard. I do also want to highlight, though, the last podcast on the left series that covered this case was extremely well done. They had a ton of really good research. I also took a lot from Jodi Arias in American Murder Mystery and Jodi Arias in Defense Of.
Mm-hmm.
I also used plenty of news sources and literally any interview I could find. Please feel free to check them all out. And of course, as always, if you could just like download, leave us a little like, comment, tell us what you thought about the episode. Leave us like a 5-star review if you could. Maybe a little comment.
Maybe you want to follow us on Instagram. Maybe you want to tell a friend. Maybe you want to tell an acquaintance. Maybe you want to tell a foe. I don't know. I'm not you.
Ooh, yeah.
I'm not you, babe.
Also, if you were like really feeling it deep in your bones, you could look for merch on Redbubble. You could send us a pod pet, a hometown murder that you want us to cover.
You could stay tuned because we really want to get merch off of the ground here, and we get a lot of messages asking for it. So
yes, we
you
do.
Just stay tuned, babe.
Stay tuned. It's coming. And last but not least, a little recap.
Mm.
If you missed last week, I heavily recommend going back to listen to all of the nuance and context that this case deserves, but I'm just doing a wee little summary in case you wanted to jog your memory. Last week, we talked about the culture of Mormonism and specifically the law of chastity surrounding sex, love, and marriage. We also went over how Jody and Travis met, their sexy little secret relationship, and the inner conflict this gave Travis. Travis and Jody dated for roughly 4 to 5 months, broke up, and continued to have an on-again, off-again, sexy friends with benefits question mark relationship for the next year.
Yeah, that's a way to describe it.
Yeah. During that year, Travis did date two other women in hopes of finding the perfect Mormon wife. Jody, after the breakup, moved to his town, then moved back home, and then on June 9th, 2008, Travis Alexander was found dead in his own shower by a woman named Mimi he was going to bring as a date on a trip to Cancun.
I feel so bad for that woman.
And that's what you missed on Glee. You know? I do feel really bad for her, especially like, I don't know, I just imagined her being so excited to go on this trip and like getting all geared up for it, and then the day you're supposed to leave comes and goes and you're not hearing from him, and then nobody else is hearing from him, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna go check on him, and then this is what you find.
And not only that, but like, she's got her little suitcase packed, I'm sure, and she's all excited. Yeah. and to go on a vacation with somebody, I have to imagine that like you have a good feeling about that. Yeah. Relationship, you know, and you're excited about it, and so that those initial butterflies, that honeymoon phase of dating, like you're just so excited anytime you get to spend time with each other. Like, yeah. That excitement she had to then go like, oh, maybe he doesn't like me, and then feel sad, and then kind of get like angry, like, why'd you blow me off? And yeah. Then that probably leads up to, oh, I'm worried.
Yeah.
Like, actually, I don't think he would have not answered me for this long, and what happened. So I can see like all of those emotions kind of like leading into the next one, to the next one, and then you find him.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, I don't know for sure if she had Sky and Chris Hughes' number, those close friends of Travis's that they were going to meet up with in Cancun.
Right.
But I can imagine if she did, there's got to be this moment where they're like, hey, have you heard from him?
Right. Because they're worried about him now.
Right. Because they're also trying to plan stuff for all of them to do together. So they're right. Blowing him up. And they're like, hey, guy, like, do you want to do this? Does that sound fun? And they're like, why the hell aren't you answering us? This is like a fun vacation.
Seriously. Exactly.
So on June 9th, Mimi and two friends find Travis in his shower. They actually go in, and one of his roommates was the first one to find him. But he looks bad. And I'm sure that was like beyond traumatic for them to see. Upon arrival, though, emergency response knew that this was a bad scene. Not only visually was it difficult. Again, as Allie said, you can see the photos of him, but I really, really, really don't recommend it. They were able to tell right off first glance that Travis had been dead for a couple of days. He had dark areas in his limbs where blood had pooled. He was stabbed like a crap load of different times. And his throat had been slit incredibly deep. From like ear to ear, I think it actually punctured his trachea and his esophagus. So like deep into his throat.
It exposes so much of his throat where, I mean, I think that injury alone
would have done it.
Could have killed him, even though I don't believe that was the cause of death.
No. And in fact, I think there were so many injuries, they weren't really able to tell what came first because it all happened so quickly together. But when Detective Esteban Flores from the Mesa Police Department came to the scene, he said there was blood everywhere. In fact, it was kind of a weird scene because there was blood everywhere except for the shower.
Hmm.
So the detectives and the police were actually at and processing the scene for like 3 full days. On the 2020 coverage of this case that I saw, they literally called it a slaughterhouse. Like, it was bad.
Well, and if I remember right, isn't it that I'm assuming he took like the master bedroom in the condo? So
yeah.
He had a bathroom in his like bedroom, off his bedroom, that wasn't shared with the other roommates. So
yeah, he had an ensuite. Yeah. So
That's the word I'm like trying to describe, but there's a word for it. You know it.
Yeah.
Shout it out if you know it. You found it.
All right. Class E-N. Ensuite. So that's actually a really big part of it. Because he was in the bathroom, I think it took, I'm so sorry for how graphic this is, but like it took a little bit longer for the smell to sort of get beyond the actual master bedroom doors.
Yeah, because you had to go almost through two doors, like a whole right. other room for it to reach the hallway.
And his master bedroom had been locked. So when Mimi and those two friends came over, they had to get one of the roommates to find the key to his room to unlock it to even find him. And that's why the roommate ended up finding him first. So there was blood all down like the little hallway that almost led to the bathroom in his master bedroom.
Okay.
There was also blood all over the bathroom itself. And then he was in the shower and the shower was like clean. And he seemed pretty clean. But there were a few things that were really interesting about this scene. First, it was clear that the roommates had nothing to do with this murder, but they were so fucking useless other than that one moment that they found the key to his room.
I do feel for them to be that oblivious.
But there was no evidence they came or left the entire time.
Yeah.
And that's my like, last podcast on the left. Sometimes they can get like a little bit raunchy for me. They do great research, but like one of their little shticks that they did about this was them being like, imagine being that engrossed in like your video games and being like, I don't know, maybe he left like a piece of food in there and it's just rotting. Whatever, I'm going to keep going.
No, seriously. Yeah. Or like just getting like high or drunk and just kind of like being out of it. You're like, that smell, I don't know what he's doing in there. And you're just like, kind
what
of
is he eating?
Ignoring yeah. it. It's like, oh, that's a body.
And that's a pretty distinct smell. And it had been days. Like it had been, I think, 5 days.
It's almost so- like it would smell like the trunk of Casey Anthony's car. Oops.
Whoops. Allegedly. That being said, just worth noting because what the hell?
Yeah, which I'm sure like Mimi getting there and being like, I'm sure you guys yeah. don't live like this.
Yeah.
There's something going
I've
on
here. I've
been here
enough to know that you know what a Clorox wipe is. Also, I do feel really bad for the roommate that found it. Like that is so traumatizing and this isn't to take away from that. It's just kind of like maybe next time we use our senses and we process those.
All five of them. Yep.
Yeah.
Got them for a reason.
Sure do.
But I imagined that door opening initially was like an absolute wall of yeah. just, you know, I have to think that even if you have never smelled that in your life before.
Instinctively.
And yeah, instinctually you would be able to know like that's a person. That's, I don't know, something that's biological.
Yeah. Yeah. And the third was just the little clues that they found here. There mm-hmm. was a lot of clues, evidence about how the scene was found that told them a lot about what happened or what didn't happen. So, for instance, it was weird to them that there was blood all over the bathroom and yet he had been cleaned off.
Mm.
He was sort of like crumpled up at the bottom of the shower. Like, I think it was like a stall shower, so it wasn't like a really big one.
Right.
From what I could tell. And that was pretty clean. His body was pretty clean despite the insane amount of wounds that he had. But like none of the blood in the sink or on the walls had really been attempted to be cleaned.
Yeah, I mean, so it is a stall shower. These are photos that you can see. And I mentioned I don't recommend this, so I'll just describe it to you so that you are not like
tempted
to look it yeah. up, because really you're not better for it and I don't recommend it. And I do feel bad that they are available, but you can't look at this case on like Reddit or anything without right. that coming up. But it is a stall shower and he is like, his legs are kind of like tucked up to the side of him and he is naked in the shower yeah. and like his head is just kind of to the side and he has a gaping neck wound. He's got stab wounds to his back. He has stab wounds to his chest.
Yeah.
Like he is obviously deceased and has been for a few days, but like it's almost like the killer, I don't know who it is,
yeah.
ran the shower or something yeah. like rinsed off his body, because there he really isn't as covered in blood as you know that he would need to be.
Oh yeah.
From those wounds. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. And what's interesting is that his body was so far into the decomposition process that they didn't even initially notice he'd been shot in the head. Mm-hmm. What did it for them was they found a 25 caliber casing in some of the blood. And that was like on the second or third day of processing this scene. That wasn't anywhere near the beginning.
Right. And he had so many other wounds to his body that you would have just assumed he died from something else.
Right. Exactly. Another thing that was really interesting here was that the bedding had been taken off of the bed.
Interesting.
Like the sheets were removed. And this didn't honestly initially strike them as weird. Except as they were doing sort of a walkthrough of the entire house, they saw the washing machine and the dryer. I think it was like in the basement. And they weren't even going to look at it. But one of them saw like a little weird red mark on the washer, and they ended up looking inside and found his sheets and also a camera.
All right. We'll see you next week.
Kind of a weird spot, right? They also found that it had been washed in bleach. Which is really interesting.
That is not proper linen care.
No, I don't think that would help it last very long. But I don't think whoever washed it was thinking about that.
Yeah.
It seemed like they were maybe fixated on the camera. But what do I know? They also found a few other weird like odds and ends. Like there was a handprint on one of the walls. Some fibers around the place. And there are also a bunch of brown hairs like in the sink and stuck to things.
Well, that's not our girl, because she's a natural blonde.
Well, she sure is a blonde. Naturally.
Yep.
Yeah. What becomes increasingly odd about it, though, is that sort of duality. Travis is killed brutally, and yet he's the one that's taken care of. It seems like they're trying to clean things up with the sheets and with the camera and with his body, but yet didn't care enough to pick up very obvious other mess and remains from this killing. It's just a really weird mix of care and flippant.
And like brutality.
Yeah.
It was almost like the rage and then maybe a little bit of remorse. I don't know if you call it remorse, but just like, all right, well, at least I'll make it look nice.
Right.
Kind of thing.
And also, I would say, there's sort of like that remorse piece and then an effort to like cover their own tracks of like, oh shit, okay, let me get the camera. Let me get these right, bed sheets.
Like, I feel bad, but not bad enough to go down for it.
Do I regret it? Yes. Would I do it again? Absolutely. That's what it reads to me.
Yes.
Travis clearly wasn't killed in the shower though, especially because of all of this blood. Like they could tell something went down and then he was placed back in the shower.
Right.
But he was returned and again, sort of rinsed off. And the sheets also were washed, but the camera was in there. It's just wild. So while this crime scene is like a freaking mess, it's one with a lot of clues. But it's a mess of clues.
Yes. Happy hunting.
Truly. With most of the initial work out of the way, detectives began asking questions. They were calling friends, family, acquaintances, literally anyone they thought might be able to help. And so many of them said what we've heard so much about Travis. He was jovial and kind, and people really liked him. But once they got to some of Travis's closer friends, a lot of people started talking about our girl Jody.
Well, they were like, a lot of people like him, but one person loves him.
Chris and Sky Hughes, the married couple that Travis was supposed to be seeing in Cancun, I believe they had some overlap with work. They were very good friends. They were really talking with police.
Can you imagine being that far away, though, and finding out that one of your closest friends has been brutally... Like, you're on vacation waiting for them to arrive. Like, they could have been waiting at the airport. Like, oh, their flight's, you know, supposed to be here.
Yeah.
And he never shows and you think, okay, did he miss a flight? And then he doesn't answer your text and you're like, okay, is he okay? Is his family okay?
Right.
And then it's him that's not okay. Like, he is dead. You're not going to hear from him. And then being that far away and like, you're not going to have a vacation after that. You're going to get on the next flight home and go try to help or do whatever. I mean, you're in no state to...
You're not enjoying yourself or your time.
No.
And I can just imagine, like, Chris also was the one that was supposed to be on that conference call with him at work. He had sent that text that was like, you better be dead, bro. Mm-hmm. And then he was like, oh my God. Like, oh my God. That is not what I meant. Like,
oh.
So obviously, Chris and Sky come back from this vacation and they immediately tell detectives that they should look at Jody.
As they should.
As they should. And this points the police in her direction, obviously, but they weren't the only ones, actually.
I think anybody that knew Travis well would be like, hey, is that, who's that girl mouth breathing on the window outside staring at you?
Have you talked to the girl who follows him to the bathroom while he takes a shit at the party? Like,
who listened outside the door not once but twice.
Literally. And Chris and Sky, I'm sure they hated to be right about this, but they had told him previously, they were like, we're afraid we're going to find you like chopped up in her freezer.
Yeah, an exact quote, isn't that?
Yes.
Ugh.
It's just terrifying. It's all really macabre looking back at it. But as other friends were kind of saying the same thing, they were obviously talking to them and they were trying to get a hold of Jody, but she was back in Yreka.
Yeah, so she's already back in California. They're in Arizona.
Right. And she was in an entirely different state the entire time, doing a different man during the crime.
That's an alibi.
That sure is an alibi. And there was no evidence she was anywhere even near Arizona. Plus, she's blonde. So, like, they're like, okay, sure. But, like, come on.
Yeah, but there's
Look at what's happening here.
Yeah.
Right.
You've got brunette strands.
And they were able to sort of call her because, again, she's back in Yreka. She's living with her grandparents at the time. And she had moved back a few months earlier in April of 2008 when she couldn't afford to live in Mesa anymore. Again, I think there was sort of a weird money thing. Like, I think she might have loaned Travis some money as everything with the housing market was freaking out. But it doesn't sound like she maybe made the best financial choices because she couldn't even afford to live there herself for more than a year. So she's back with her grandparents. She's living with family. And the detectives called Jody and she says, look, I liked him, but he didn't like me like that. Like, this didn't work out. And I'm actually like with someone else. I was just in a conference for prepaid legal services in Salt Lake City. I was seeing my new man's. Like, you can ask him all about it.
Okay, sounds pretty good.
And they did. And he said, yeah, she was here. She was here on the 6th. And they said, oh, because she said she left on the 4th.
Oh.
And she drove, but like it did not take that long. You know? And so the detectives continue their investigation and they realize that there's a lot more than they initially heard from her. Like the fact that it took 2 days to get somewhere. It only took maybe half a day drive to get to. Or the fact that she had dyed her hair back brown. Also,
that's the best decision she's made this whole time.
Truly. It looks great, babe. Keep it up. Pre-bangs, but we'll get there. And that they found that camera in the washer and they found that it was the year of 2008. So was it like the best DSLR Nikon 3500 you've ever seen? No. But it was in the era of waterproof SD card holders.
Yes.
So bleach or washing machine or not, the memory card where the fucking photos were was totally fucking fine.
I have so many thoughts on that, and I'm not the most tech savvy gal myself. I'll say it.
Oh, yeah.
But I feel like if I just didn't want photos to be found, I just like wouldn't leave the thing with all the photos on it there.
Also, there was nothing else here to suggest that like he had a camera or that a camera was involved. So maybe I just fucking take the camera.
Could.
The whole thing. That's possible.
I think it would be so much less suspicious if the camera were just found in one of his drawers. They might not have even looked at it, but because I don't know about you, but I don't store my camera in the washer machine.
Certainly not with sheets, like maybe a towel's load.
Or like bloodied linens.
Yeah.
Just seems like it was like you pointed them in the direction of, hey, what's on this camera? And then literally, they're like, oh, the card, it's everything's still intact.
Would you look at that?
Like, you're not going to take any more pictures with this camera, but you can see the ones that were taken.
You sure can. And so now they were in some contact with Jody. You know?
Yes.
And what's so interesting is she came back to town to Mesa to go to his memorial service.
Interesting. Okay.
So she was there. She saw his family. She tried to offer her condolences. They didn't give a shit because their son was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the detectives were like, hey, babe, while you're in town, we're just trying to get some DNA, collect things for everybody. Can we get some fingerprints, handprints, all that? And she was like, yeah, anything to help.
Okay.
And now she didn't really ask any fucking questions at all, which maybe would have been good.
Like, what happened to him? Why? I mean, if she's heard, though.
She's heard. I also think that there's been, like, a few phone calls, so it's not, like, the very first time they're getting in touch. They're like, hey, come give us your thumbprints. And she's like, okay. I think she's like, anything to help.
But, you know, they also work together, so I'm sure people at work were talking about it. Like, I mean, the same company. I don't know how big it was, but if she could work there from California,
right,
then they must have been doing something. And, you know, she could have heard some details.
Yeah, and also, I think she was under the impression that, like, if I give them my handprint, if I give them my fingerprints, then I'm helping. I'm doing everything I can. I'm so compliant. I'm so helpful.
Mm.
You know?
Yep.
But the thing is, Jody didn't ask any questions. So she didn't ask why they wanted any of these things, which if she had, they would know that she would know that maybe they were trying to link up some fingerprints or handprints to what was found at the crime. In blood.
I mean, does she think they're just collecting them for shits and gigs? Like, she's got to be wondering at this point.
It's a scrapbook.
Did I leave anything?
I don't know what you're talking about. She was banging her other boyfriend in Salt Lake.
But
the thing is,
that's why there's a part three.
She thinks that. But the police are now increasingly on the case of, did Jody Arias kill this fucking man? Because there are no photos that tie Jody to the crime. They found out that these brunette hairs now match Jody's. They learned that Jody was driving around the days of the crime, that there are significant periods of time missing around the time she was driving when the crime occurred, and there was one last little nail in that coffin. See, you remember that bullet casing they found at the scene of the 25 caliber bullet?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they started getting all of these fingers pointed at Jody, and some of the other stuff seemed fishy, and they wanted to look into it, but they did find out that just a few weeks earlier, oddly enough, there had actually been a robbery at Jody's grandparents' home where she was living.
Oh.
Someone broke in. How scary is that? So violating. They stole $30, a DVD player, and a 25 caliber handgun from her grandfather's collection.
Only those things, huh?
And 30 of her dollars.
You hate to see it.
I mean, there was a whole collection of handguns, and they only took one and 30 of her dollars. Her hard-earned dollars.
Rat bastards.
That prepaid legal, that's like a third of what she brings home every year. Come on. Sorry. MLM joke. Could she have been their guy? Was there any reasonable chance?
Interesting. So did she make the report to the police about this robbery at the grandparents' house? Or were the grandparents like, who the hell took my gun and $30?
I am not sure, but it sounds like she was at least welcome to talking about it because I believe it was 30 of her dollars.
Oh.
So I don't know if she's the one that made the call, but she at least participated enough to talk to him about it.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And obviously, she's in a different state. They're not, like, super easily bringing her in to talk to her. And as they're getting all of this evidence, they hear about this break-in, and then they get the photos back. And, we really gave a spoiler alert, but, like, the photos were of Jody. All of Jody.
Mm.
From head to toe, or camel toe, and everything in between, you know?
Yes. And so do we know the timestamp on those photos?
Oh, we sure do, babe. There are photos of the day that they believe he was actually killed on, which is June 4th.
Oh, wow.
There are timestamps of the afternoon from somewhere like 1 or 2 p.m. to like 5:30 p.m. on the day that they believe Travis was murdered.
Okay.
And there's also a whole lot of photos of her booty, her tatas, and Mr. Travis.
Mm.
Yeah. These photos are a lot. A lot.
Not great, though, because there's really not a whole lot she can do to deny, like, that's not me in that photo. It's very...
Okay.
Very clearly her. And sure. From the day that he's... That based on the autopsy, they believed he died, that's pretty damning.
Especially with, like, a few hour long window of timestamps from that day. And it's interesting because I think it even started with a few of him. Like, just trying to be, like, hot and sexy and being around. And then there was her. There was like a full frontal photo.
Mm.
There was one of her like kind of, I think, laying down like with little braids in her hair, like pigtail braids, which is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a choice. She's already brunette in these photos.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Which is a very curious thing because naturally we knew she was a blonde.
Yep.
You know, even her eyebrows, even though they tell you not to do that on the package.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
she did a lot of things that they say, hey, this is a rule. Don't break it.
Well, but what if she did?
Allegedly.
Allegedly. So the detectives are going through all these photos and they're like going, I recognize that face. I recognize that face. And then, boom, there's just a big old photo of a booty hole. Right. That's all I got. That's all I can say. It is just butthole and vagina. That's it.
It's a chocolate starfish.
Don't you mean the back door?
Oh, I thought you meant the poop chute.
Is that a puckered date that I see?
Is that a stink star?
You mean the fart box?
You mean the stink tunnel?
Are you telling me there's a photo of a leather Cheeto?
Hold on. I think you mean the poop poop.
No, actually, what I really meant was the glistening chrysanthemum. Thank you, Reddit.
Oh, goodness. Oh, that's so, some very much needed levity.
So imagine with me, you're just like a fucking detective. You're going through stuff. You're processing evidence. You're like, hair, hair, hair.
Yes.
Palm print. SD card. Pop that in my computer. And you get this glistening chrysanthemum up in your face.
Correct.
You know? And then the face of a woman who's like, but I was with my new boyfriend.
Yes.
Ma'am.
They're time stamped, homegirl.
They're time stamped. And so they don't need Jody to be there for this.
Mm.
And the detectives and the police department were able to indict Jody on July 9th, 2008 for first degree murder.
Wow. So about a month later.
Yes.
They got her.
On her fucking birthday.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so Detective Flores and some other detectives go out to California to arrest her.
She must have been floored.
Flores? No, okay. So she was like under the impression that they were just bringing her in for questioning. They're like, can you come down to the station? And she was like, sure. I'll come right on down.
We just want you to wear these silver bracelets behind your back.
We think they look really good with the new hair color.
Correct.
No, no, no. They try to get what they can out of her first.
Naturally. That makes sense.
As they, you know, I think should. So they get down there on July 15th of 2008. And this is when all of this starts happening.
So July 15th is when Jody is now in Arizona.
Because Jody they invited is her. Still in California. They went out to her.
Okay, so they know they can arrest her on July 9th. They go out to California. July 15th, they speak with her. She thinks this is just a conversation. They know no matter what, they're arresting her.
Yes.
They just want to know what she'll give up before they do.
Yes.
Okay.
And they say, come on, sit on down.
Ooh.
And for those of you who don't know, every fucking interrogation is videotaped. You can pretty much assume anywhere in society, but specifically in law enforcement buildings, you're going to be on fucking recording.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you didn't know that, but now you know it. And I would tuck that in your little back pocket for later because she clearly didn't. She really clearly didn't.
No.
But what's fascinating to me is that Jody does not seem worried at all. She is not concerned about herself, even though she's talked to them on the phone. And historically, that's all they've needed from her. She's now given them her fingerprints, her DNA. And now they've come to her. And she's like, oh, yeah, anything to help an old friend. You know? Detective Flores said that it felt like it was more Jody interrogating him than he her. So it's curious, but they start this interrogation and Jody essentially is saying like, oh my gosh, have you heard from him? I heard that this happened this way. I've heard that they think this might have happened. Like, what happened?
Interesting.
And they're like, yeah, what happened? Basically. And she starts by basically saying like, oh my goodness, anything to help figure this out. And Detective Flores is sitting there with her and he's like, okay, so what were you doing at this time? And Jody says, I was going to Salt Lake City, but silly me, I got lost along the way and I had to rent a car and my phone died because I forgot my charger in the old one. But you know, somehow I got off of Route 15. It got really late. And like, this is a direct quote. I'm not above sleeping in the car. So apparently she fell asleep for a long time, 10 hours. And then makes her way back onto the route and goes up to Salt Lake City. And now, according to her, she accidentally gets lost for 100 miles.
I am not the right person to judge her on this because I am not directionally gifted. You could spin me around 3 times and I would not know how to get home.
But here's the thing. 100 miles or 160.9 kilometers is like at least an hour and a half of driving in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah, that's a minimum.
Yeah. With no stops for gas or food or a walk or traffic. To just like, oh, that's so silly me. I got real lost in my audiobook for 3 fucking hours.
Yeah, that's a bit of time. So if she's coming up from California, going south to Salt Lake City, she entirely missed her destination, right?
Kind of. So from what I understand, it's kind of like a little bit of a north drive because I think she had to go south a little bit to get on the interstate that connected her to Utah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a checkmark looking drive. Typically, which still, I have to wonder, like, how do you get on the right highway and then get off? Because what I think she was saying was she did sort of the down trip of the check mark and then got on the part that goes up towards Utah and then somehow got off of that part and got lost for 100 miles.
Okay.
Which is absolutely fucking batshit to me. I don't know. So she's like, yeah, all right, I end up sleeping for hours. And then I end up in Utah. I see my new boy that I like, kind of like. I go to this conference for prepaid legal. I see a bunch of my friends. We actually talked about Travis because obviously it's prepaid legal and everybody knows him there. And then I came home. And here I am.
And they were like, but your butthole says otherwise.
And he said, but Beavis and Butthead said you needed TP for your bunhole. Is that still true? No, I'm kidding. Detective Flores actually said, okay, babe, but here's the thing.
I don't think he said babe.
He said, okay, crazy. But with this story, even with you getting lost 100 miles and sleeping like 10 hours in your car, there's still 18 hours that are completely unaccounted for.
Yeah, that's problematic.
So what were you doing in those? And she was like, no, I told you I got lost. My phone died, so I couldn't figure it out. I slept and then I got back on track. And they're like, Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Sure, Jan. Detective Flores is like, mm-hmm, but still, even with the 18 hours, even if it was just the 18 hours, that's still enough time to go see your friend Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And come back, even if you got off track, and still end up where you did when you did.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, that's fucking crazy. I was nowhere near Travis. I wasn't even there. I wasn't even in the state. And Detective Flores goes, okay, we're going to switch things up. Cut the shit.
Yeah.
Cut the shit. I know you were there. We know you were there. We think you killed him. Tell us what happened. And she is just like absolutely refusing to give anything. She was not there. She wasn't in the state. She didn't see him.
Yeah.
She went straight to see her new beau. She got confused. She got lost. Her phone died. She is not above sleeping in the car.
Mm-mm.
And then she went. She saw him. She fucked him. She bought property. She came home.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't really buy property. She probably bought legal aid. But you know what I mean?
Yep.
And Detective Flores is like, okay, all right, so here's the thing. Your hair is at the scene. Your blood is at the scene. We have photos of you at the scene. And she goes, well, of course my hair and my blood are at the scene. I've been there. I've been there a ton. I just wasn't there that day.
She does have a point.
She does. And a lie. Two truths and a lie, you know, well, figure it out. And so he also says, okay, all right. Well, we have those photos. And we have these photos of that poop shoot you're carrying around in that derriere. And she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. So he goes, do you want to see the photos? And she's like, yes, I want to see the photos. Show me the photos on this camera that you think connect me to the crime. And he said, okay, here's your face.
She's like, that's not me.
I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. She looks at it. She does the world's weirdest fucking acting job. And she's like, I mean, yeah, wow, that really looks like me.
AI like, was crazy in 2008.
That is you. It does not look like you. It is you. And she's like, listen, I don't know. Photoshop exists. I'm sure you can tamper with the date and the time. But like, that's not me. I wasn't there. Bitch.
I will give her credit that she committed to the bit.
Yeah, she really did commit to that bit. I can't imagine being in an interrogation room in like that sort of beige white wall, tiny square with like a little table between you, and like a detective comes out and shows you a blown up photo of your own butthole. And you're like, well, that looks like my butthole.
In her defense, she's probably never seen it. So
I don't know. She liked to take photos.
Well,
she was an amateur photographer.
That is true.
So who knows what kind of adult film she was developing?
It is true.
Who knows?
But I can understand her saying, listen, we dated. It makes sense that you would find evidence of my being there before.
Because I have been.
But I wasn't. And I truly think that if she had taken that camera or destroyed those photos before she left, I do think she could have gotten away with it. Because this really is what gives them the, your time and place is right here. Yes. I mean, her story doesn't really add up with the timeline. But how else are you really going to put her there?
Fair. And I will say, there's plenty of other evidence that adds to this case.
I know.
But I don't know that it would have been as heavy of a hitter without a time and date stamped camera evidence of her being there. But the thing that's really interesting to me is that the photos they show her aren't just nudes. Because there were a few other photos they found that I kind of left out. See, the camera malfunctioned. And you might think to yourself, but Abby, of course it did. It was in the fucking washer with bleach.
Abby, of course it did. It was in the fucking washer with bleach.
Oh, you silly goose. Yeah. No, it misfunctioned. It malfunctioned while she was there.
Okay.
So there's all of these photos of the two of them sort of like, for lack of a better term, fucking around, like taking these photos that they think are hot. And then there's this series of them like a few hours later around 5:30 where he's in the shower. And these are the last photos of him taken. And he's like kind of doing some poses. He's like washing off. And then there's one of his face where he just looks like he's seen a ghost.
That photo is accessible and it is haunting.
And then there's a few of blurry rubbish. And a few after that. So even when, if we're going to pretend it wasn't Jody, whoever was there was taking these photos, they thought they stopped and they either put the camera down or they dropped the camera, but the camera kept taking photos. Including during this crime.
Oh.
So there is one of like a foot and a leg and then a very obviously bloody thigh.
Oh, no.
And so Detective Flores is showing this to her. He's like, that is your foot. That is your foot and that is his body. And she's like, that's not my foot. So she's not giving in. Again, she's got this really weird acting thing. I don't know how you can look at your own butt and face side by side, time stamped, and go, wow, that really does look like me.
Today, with what AI can do, you bet your bottom dollar. But in 2008, not likely. Pun intended. Yes. Yes.
All right. I will say, there is a moment where they try to like switch out and use a female detective. But that does not go well. Jody doesn't quite seem to be like a girl's girl, you know?
I thought you'd say that.
Yeah, she was really kind of a boy's girl. So she was like, all right, fine. Like, get this bitch out of here. I'll talk to Detective Flores. Get her out.
Really?
Yeah, she was like, I'm not talking to her.
Well, and I do think that Jody, I mean, she is very beautiful.
Yeah.
And I could see her, like, in another way, being very friendly and bubbly, but, like, feeling more comfortable, probably more willing to be a little bit more open with a male, especially if she found him attractive.
Yeah.
I don't know what these officers looked like, but I would assume if they put their most handsome in, that she might be more willing to speak with them.
Detective Flores is handsome, but as we'll hear about in next episode, I don't think she cares that much.
Okay.
But essentially, this doesn't really work. And when she gets arrested, so Detective Flores like kind of leaves the room. She still doesn't know what's happening. She's denying adamantly everything.
She's not in cuffs. She has no reason to believe that she's not going to be able to leave.
Right.
Okay.
So he leaves. I don't know if they have to do paperwork to process the arrest or if he's just giving her time to like see what happens.
Part of it is also like a part of the game. They like make you sit with it and kind of watch you from another room to see what you do while you're alone.
And watch they did.
Yeah.
Watch they did. Because she's sitting there. He's left. She's sort of like sitting at the table, just sort of twiddling her thumbs, so to speak. She starts doing some stretches. She does like a little back stretch over the back of the chair. She starts like, I don't know, getting curious, rummaging through the trash.
I've never gotten so curious. I go through the trash.
No, never?
No.
Well, you're not the same. Because she's like looking through it. She starts talking to herself. She's like, I don't think it's like really audible, but like you can tell she's like muttering shit to herself. And then she does a headstand.
Sorry, what?
Yes. While she's alone in the interrogation room, she leans her entire body upside down against the wall to do a headstand.
So she is just so significantly not taking this seriously.
Ready? Okay.
No, seriously, but yeah. Like that, I think that just shows how little this meant to her.
And then she starts singing to herself.
Yeah, I knew you'd say that.
And my favorite part of this is like, so she sings Oh Holy Night. I think she sings another song before that.
Christmas in July.
Yeah, we love it.
Mm.
But she is singing it and sort of, okay, you know when you like say a song and someone's like, what song? And you're like, like you kind of like half-ass sing it.
Yep.
For like a few bars to see if they know it. It's like she's doing that line by line to herself to be like, you remember? You remember? So it's like, Oh, holy night. The stars are bright. Like,
no.
Yes. Like, it's so drawn out and it's like kind of breathy and quiet, like to herself. And it is so fucking strange. Like, it's not, that's not an admission of guilt. That's not, that's nothing, but it is something. You know what I mean?
It's not nothing.
It's not nothing, but it's something, you know?
Mm.
And so she gets arrested. He comes back and he's like, listen, cutie, you're under arrest. You have the right to remain silent. Starts going through all of it. And she is sobbing. She's like, if Travis was alive, he'd tell you that I didn't do this.
You're right, because Travis would be alive.
Yes. That's a good one. Yeah.
Fuck.
So like, she's like, he wouldn't do this. I'm innocent. I didn't hurt him. I never wanted to hurt him. And like, they go through all of this. She's crying. And then she does this thing that like kind of gets me. She starts crying. She goes, can I ask something? And it's going to show you what an awful, shallow person I am. And he's like, what? And she's like, can I have some makeup or like clean myself up before I get my photo taken?
Oh, Jody.
And he literally sits there. He goes, you're going to be taken as you are.
Yeah.
And then she gets to this place where they're doing her mugshot and she fucking smiles. She does like a little glamour shot. She's like, who, me?
I know.
And that's what gets broadcast everywhere.
And I mean, it pretty accurately depicts how she's treating the situation.
Yeah.
But I think it also kickstarted this whole, like, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
She couldn't do this. Could she do this? She did it.
Sure as shit. You can bet your poop shoot.
Your bottom dollar.
Now, here's where we're going to just take a little break and we're going to end today after this part. But we are really going to look at the mental health piece here.
Yep.
Because clearly there's a mental health piece here.
Yes.
And obviously Jody is struggling with something. I don't know if she's really having a hard time with it, but it's going on. And I want to make sure I note here that here at ATFTC, we try to be very trauma-informed, and we also don't believe mentally ill people are bad or dangerous. Mental health is a real struggle for a lot of people, and you never choose to get any mental health, but we also are realists. We know that hurt people hurt people, and the only way to manage your mental health is to do it. And so the only person who can manage your mental health is you.
Which means you have to what? Want to.
Yes. And while you didn't cause your own hurt, you are the only one responsible for making sure that you don't hurt other people because of it. And the only other little upfront clause I'm going to give you all here is that I'm not a licensed therapist. I just have my degree in psychology and I read the DSM-5 for fun, which is basically like the diagnostic manual. I like it as light reading.
Yeah.
Before bed. You know.
She's like, this is my shitter book.
Ew. I'm never there that long. With that out of the way.
You're just not there that often.
Okay, true. But I like a little trauma and stress related disorder before bed. You know? Yes,
just a little trauma for the table. Let's be
we'll
bad.
Be bad. So with that out of the way, Jody is dealing with a lot. And I've watched and read a lot about what people think her mental health is, a lot of what people have attributed to her. And I actually watched a really interesting breakdown from a psychologist, Dr. Todd Grande, who reviewed a lot of Jody's symptoms and the common diagnoses that are thrown out for her.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three in particular that come back a lot for Jody in my research, and that's borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Without going entirely clinical on you all and so, so dry, there are a few reasons that I think none of these diagnoses fully work, but I do think borderline personality is the best one.
I think
out of the three of them.
I do think borderline gets you the closest.
Yes.
I would also argue like some kind of psychopathy here.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a really interesting point with the borderline, and I'll go into all of them. But I also just want to let you guys know some of what I talk about does come up in the trial. So I'm going to say, oh, this person presented this.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't gotten to the trial yet, but that's where at least post-traumatic stress comes in. Like, that was presented by defense. So that's where I'm getting that one from.
Okay.
But I also think it's important to say, like, obviously, a psychologist who works more closely with someone and has more information certainly would have better knowledge than I would. But Dr. Grande also actually brought up a really good point in that he was talking about how to get, like, the diagnostic material needed with a lot of the diagnoses that we see floating around for her, you would get a different answer based on how much of her history you look at. So for a lot of diagnoses, to be given a diagnosis, you have to have a certain amount of symptoms of the ones listed. They have to be so impactful or like interfere with your life to a certain degree. It can't be better described by something else, and it has to be going on for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
For some diagnoses, this means like you have to have certain symptoms predating turning 18. Like, you have to show them as a child. For some, it's like the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends. But also, if you're looking at diagnoses that really talk about your interpersonal relationships, are we talking about all of your interpersonal relationships? Are we talking about just the romantic ones? Are we talking about the most recent ones? All of them? And so this was really curious to think about and sort of look at. And also, remembering that what we have to see and watch and sort of like dissect of her behavior is all at a really high stress time of her being in court. So is that maybe the best way to get a read on her baseline? No.
Mm-mm.
But I do think out of everything I've seen, borderline seems like it fits the best. So let's talk about it. We'll go over a slight overview of all of the diagnoses that I've heard, and then we'll sort of see how they fit or don't fit. With post-traumatic stress disorder, this was brought up by defense, and PTSD is a trauma and stress disorder which impacts people's lives after experiencing a traumatic event that leads to a variety of symptoms such as reliving the event, extreme distress, and specific avoidance of anything that reminds them of that trauma, unwanted reliving or recollection of the event, negative moods or thoughts as a result, and higher levels of reactivity or hypervigilance, which is like when people get really angry or sort of have an explosive episode around these sort of triggers, as an example of like what you might see for that.
Mm-hmm.
The diagnosis is brought up in court for Jody from the defense. And I think this is really interesting because it sort of has this sympathetic undertone to it. I have a really hard time dissecting how mental health is brought up in court because obviously it plays a role. How we perceive things to be is oftentimes our reality. And so reacting or acting under that reality has to be taken into account when you're looking at a court of law and what a quote unquote reasonable person would do.
Mm-hmm.
But also, mental health has historically had a lot of stigma to it. So diagnoses such as borderline personality disorder or something like bipolar or a reactive attachment disorder might have a more of a difficult or aggressive connotation associated with them than something like PTSD or anxiety or depression that feel a little more common and a little more sympathetic. So it's very curious to see how certain things are brought up. But I don't really think that Jody displays almost any symptoms of PTSD.
Mm.
And part of what they use to bring up this diagnosis is her memory loss. So she claims that she loses memory for giant gaps of time. And we'll get there. But like, she sort of has this notion that she loses like hours of time.
Okay.
At some point. And if you were here for our Teal Swan series, memory loss is typical for trauma, but not this way. And I forget which part of that series it was, like which episode in that series we go over it, but we go over trauma and like how trauma impacts the way that memory is coded in our brains. And so we're likely to have small gaps of memory, but we're not likely to have large ones. And this is sort of why when you see like trauma depicted in media, there's like a lot of clips of things that seem kind of unrelated of like, oh, this was happening and then this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you talk to someone who's in like a major car accident, you might be like, oh, we were stopped at the red light and suddenly the car was in our car. Where like you might not remember the second or millisecond leading up to it where the car actually hits your car, but you remember that impact.
Mm-hmm.
So does it impact memory? Yes. But does it impact memory in terms of like hours? No. And that's not usually what like traumatic amnesia is or looks like.
Well, I was going to say, and because part of the diagnosis needs to be that it can't better be explained by something else.
Right.
And that something else might not be mental health related. For example, like you could have a vitamin deficiency, and however right. that plays is like now you have these bouts of amnesia where that isn't necessarily mental health. It could be something neurological going on or biological going on where right. there's something else. And I'm completely pulling that from thin air. But in order for it to meet the diagnostic criteria for it to be PTSD means that like it, again, it also has to not be better explained right. by some other things. And that doesn't only mean what's in that book. It can be any other thing too, which is why mental right. health diagnoses are very important and you should not just hand them out.
Yes. And what fucking traumatic event?
Well, I mean that too.
Like, don't get me wrong. Obviously, like, also we talked about in the Teal Swan series, a lot of little traumas can add up to a big trauma. But, like, what fucking event?
Mm-hmm.
And where is any evidence of avoidance of this? Where is any evidence of, like, reliving this? Like, people get PTSD attacks. There are people with PTSD that get, like, intrusive visuals or memories of the things that have happened to them. Or they believe that they're re-experiencing it, that they're back in it. Like, you see with a lot of stereotypical sort of portrayals of army vets and sort of reliving war when they come back and you hear a loud noise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
So I don't think that that is really a good diagnosis for her. The next two are a little bit different from that because they're both personality disorders. And specifically, they're both cluster B personality disorders. Personality disorders are mental health diagnoses that impact how you think and behave. And there are a few different clusters that sort of group a few diagnoses together with like an overarching theme. But cluster B personality disorders specifically are sort of infamous in their difficulty for treatment. And typically a pretty intense negative impact on their day-to-day life and relationships. Cluster B specifically refers to personality disorders that are marked by very dramatic, unpredictable, and intensely emotional traits. And two of the three or four, I think there's only three, are thrown out for Jody frequently by different people.
Mm.
The first and most frequent, in my opinion, and I also believe most accurate, is borderline personality disorder. This is typically seen as a pattern of instability of interpersonal relationships. You need to have most or all of the symptoms following to get this diagnosis. So you would have to have fear of abandonment, unstable relationships, unstable self-image, impulsive or self-damaging behaviors, suicidal behavior, self-injury, varied or random mood swings, constant feelings of worthlessness or sadness, problems with anger, and stress-related paranoia or loss of contact with reality. I'm going to go into that more in just a second,
mm-hmm.
but I do just want to go over narcissistic really quick and then we'll wrap back around.
Mm-hmm.
The other cluster B disorder that she's often said to have is narcissistic personality disorder. NPD is characterized by pervasive patterns of grandiosity, need for admiration, and lack of empathy. Symptoms include having a grandiose sense of self-importance, having preoccupations with unlimited riches, success, beauty, power, brilliance, etc., having a belief that they are special and can only be understood by other special people, require excessive admiration, having a sense of entitlement, taking advantage of others to meet their own needs, show a lack of empathy, is often envious of others or convinced that others are envious of them, or show arrogant or haughty behaviors. Now, do I think that Jody has narcissistic tendencies? Sure. Do I think that those add up enough to fully meet the diagnostic criteria for the disorder? No.
I also think that does she have like just plainly narcissistic traits?
Yeah.
Yeah. But does she meet, like, does she have narcissistic personality disorder traits.
Not sure.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I think that, like, oh, can I do my makeup before I do this? You could call that vanity. You could also call that, like, self-esteem issues. Like, she's so afraid to not look her best that even despite the circumstances, she wants to look that. But I think that, like, you could call her kind of self-absorbed to worry about that in that moment. But does that mean, like, narcissistic personality disorder, narcissism?
Right. And I think for me, some of the issues here is, like, I guess some of these things come through in some of her actions, but they aren't sort of the overarching obsession or, like, pervasive fixation on these things. Like, she doesn't believe that she's so special. Only other special people can understand her. There's no, like, I'm the most beautiful person in the world. I am the richest person in the world. Like, I'm going to be so powerful one day. It's right. just like, I want to look nice. Mm-hmm. And I think I can get away with stuff and I'll take advantage of people.
Mm-hmm.
But to an extent where that impacts her entire daily living, I don't think so.
I also don't think that the most important person to herself all of the time is her.
No. And that's honestly why I think borderline personality disorder is a far better fit.
Yeah. It's the hyperfixation on another person.
And actually, it was funny that you brought up psychosis because initially, and this is not like, this is no longer quote unquote valid, but how borderline personality started in its naming was borderline between neuroses and psychosis.
Okay.
So that was really interesting. It's like, that's how they came up with borderline. A lot of people are like, borderline what? Like,
yeah,
I'm on the border of what? And it's sort of that combination of like, sort of loss of touch with reality and this neurotic fixation on certain things.
Mm.
And I think that you can really see a lot of this in her, like the fear of abandonment. I don't know, man. She's following him to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
She's a literal puppy dog. She will not be abandoned for 5 minutes in the hot tub.
Mm.
Kind of fear of abandonment.
Yep.
Unstable relationships. This is one that seemed kind of difficult to prove beyond Travis. Travis himself, yes, absolutely. That was not a stable relationship, but it was also one of all of her others. Now, it doesn't sound like she had a ton of really close friends, which maybe is an example of that. But like in terms of her personal relationships, her family, she was close with her grandparents. I mean, she was a little distant from her immediate family after the weed incident. But like other than that, she had other romantic relationships that were stable and long term. She had a boyfriend of 4 years. Like, this was where I found it really interesting to sort of look at that history in the context of like, how are we really identifying relationships and which ones?
Mm.
The other thing that is not super present, I think, are like unstable self-image. It doesn't seem like she has a really unstable image of herself. She knows she's smart. She knows she's pretty. She likes artsy stuff. She gets into photography. That all kind of remains consistent throughout her life. Mm-hmm. If we're going to talk about anything, maybe it's the religion.
Yep.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't feel like enough to really say it's an unstable sense of self.
No.
That being said, the other things, absolutely. Impulsive or self-damaging behaviors. She's fucking impulsive a lot.
A lot.
There's suicidal behavior or self-injury. This we don't touch on a ton in this series, but she did threaten to kill herself a lot if Travis didn't do certain things. Like, she was like, I need to see you or I'm going to kill myself.
But was that a genuine threat? Or was that indicative of a mental health concern where she would even consider threatening that?
Right.
Even if she wasn't going to do that because of her not getting her way and whatever that was, whatever it was that she wanted, that desired result, she was like, well, this will yield that for me.
Right. And I don't know. And that's part of why I don't bring it up a lot is like, it's hard to really identify the root of that, but it did happen. And clearly that was important for him because he was like, oh my God, like she's going to hurt herself.
Right.
And so he took it seriously, regardless of sort of the motive or intent there, I guess. There's also varied or random mood swings. This just feels kind of
on brand.
Consistent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Constant feelings of worthlessness or sadness. Now, I'm not entirely sure of this one, but this does kind of check to me with the, like, if I don't see you, I'm going to kill myself. I drove all this way in the middle of the night because I needed to see you. Like, there's this sort of urgency and fear of that abandonment or of being alone that she can't get away from him from.
And up to that point, like, up to the murder, I feel for her.
Oh, absolutely.
On a human level. And I feel for her, like, as a girl's girl, to be like, baby girl, you are getting strung around a little bit. Like, he is keeping you around for a good time, but not a long time. And then he was like, no, I am done. And he was ready to move on. And because they had always kind of like blurred those boundaries and there was always a gray area between them that she just kind of kept coming back.
Right.
But when he was like, no, I'm really done this time, like getting to that point with her, I do feel for her. And I could see that if she was struggling with self-esteem or, you know, impulsivity or anything else, I can see how all of those things, like, she could show up and mouth breathe on the window staring at him
right
with another woman. But like leading up to the murder, I feel for her. And if I were her friend, I would be like, let's meet somebody else, let's go out, let's this. Have a girls' night, let's do something where, like, I think she needed somebody to do that.
Oh yeah,
because this end result is so horrific. But
it's fascinating to me that, like, honestly, even Sky tried to do that kind of, and not necessarily to her, but to Travis, where she was like, like, you are not treating her well.
Yeah. If you were treating one of my friends like that, I wouldn't let them see you, kind of thing. It's kind of like, didn't right. she say that about her sister?
Yeah. She was like, if it was my little sister, no, it wouldn't be like,
right.
So I really think something that's interesting here, and this is not part of the diagnostic. Material or like requirements to get PPD, but sort of a common phenomenon with people who have borderline is that they have this sort of favorite person. And this is someone in their life. It could be anyone, your mom, your sister, your best friend, your cousin, a rando that you meet on the street one day and suddenly you can't live without. And not to say that their attachment is like without reason, but it could literally be anybody that becomes your favorite person. And this is an individual that they prefer above all others and they feel they cannot live without. And they sort of are so, for lack of a better term, like white knuckling this relationship with that person, that it's this like, if I do something, you need to approve every single fucking thing I do or I'm going to lose it. Because you matter to me above all else and oftentimes above themselves.
And it's gripping somebody so tightly that you are pushing them away, and it is that constant like push and pull too, because you are so obsessed that it's overwhelming for the recipient, but you can't handle not
right
being, and so you'll do anything to make it whatever. But like, they need to know their place too.
Yes. And it's also hard because usually someone who has this favorite person, they sort of idolize them at first, they get really intense, they get really close, and then if, again, they perceive any rejection, so it could even just be like, hey, do you want to go to this pizza place, and they're like, no, I'm not feeling pizza today, like they can respond to that with such despair and like despondence, and like it's just crushing, and that's real to them. Like, that's a very real perception of like rejection and dejection to them. And it can be exhausting to be that favorite person. But then, of course, if you're that individual's like hyperfixation favorite person, any amount of pull away is going to be felt really heavily. So even if that pull away is like, huh, the last time I didn't want to get pizza, you cried for an hour. I don't know that I want to be close enough that you're crying for an hour if I don't want to get pizza. That's going to make it worse.
Yeah.
And so it's this really odd thing. And I think that people who are a favorite person, like, this can be a healthy dynamic if you're going to therapy and you know how to communicate and you're able to like identify that that's what's happening. But often, especially if it's in a relationship, it's really hard to tell at first, because like you're talking about earlier with Mimi, like, you get those butterflies, you're excited, you want to spend time together. And so when both of you are feeling that, it's like euphoric for the person with borderline. And so I think that's kind of what happened here. And from my best take, that's what's going on with her and Travis, is like, this is her favorite person. Any rejection is so bad that she is like actually in despair over it. And anytime there's something good, it's euphoric.
And not for nothing too, but her previous relationships were was a man who was significantly older than her, which she probably wasn't connecting mm-hmm. with as well on an emotional level. And the one before that was a gas station want-to-be vampire in
yes
California.
Yes, and I believe his magician roommate.
That, yeah. So
that's a statement.
When you have that, and then you meet somebody who has it together, is doing well, is handsome, is giving you attention, is into you too, is right. all of those things, and like you compare it to what she had been used to.
Right.
That I think that that almost adds to the like euphoria, like out of everyone in the room, he chose me.
Right. He chose me. And so, you know, I think that it's also important of everything else with the borderline is to look at that symptom of stress-related paranoia or loss of contact with reality. If this favorite person phenomenon is playing into this sort of distress and rejection that she's perceiving, and that's causing her stress, that can increase those sort of like psychosis symptoms, that loss of touch with reality. Because I don't think that it's paranoia. I don't see paranoia in her. I see absolute loss of touch with reality.
Mm.
And so I think she starts to come up with stories to sort of tell herself and starts to believe them to make sense of what's happening. And then every time she's brought back to reality of like, no, moving to Arizona isn't going to make this work. It's like another blow.
Mm.
That being said, in my absolute ideal world, in the DSM-6, they add a cluster B personality disorder called unspecified cluster B personality disorder, in which people who struggle with any symptoms from various cluster B diagnoses across the board but don't have enough of one to be diagnosed with just that one can fall into.
I like it.
It's like other specified feeding and eating disorders.
Yep.
If you don't have like specifically pica, anorexia, or bulimia.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the catch-all for like, well, you have like three of each, but not the five that you needed.
Right. Literally.
Yep.
So that's my petition. ATFTC petitions for unspecified cluster B personality disorder, please. But ultimately, again, this is just a tool for identifying and diagnosing. I'm not a therapist. I don't have the ability to diagnose someone. But from my understanding, I think this is what fits best. That being said, I also think when it comes to Jody's mental health, it's important to remember that, again, we are onlookers, but it's curious that with the upcoming trial that we'll see that defense uses PTSD while prosecution uses BPD, I think the nuance and sort of the stigma around different mental health disorders plays such a role. And I actually really agreed in that video I saw of Dr. Todd Grande. He was talking about how it's frustrating as a psychologist to look on these court cases and sort of feel like you can get a therapist to give you whatever diagnosis fits your defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I don't love it. I don't think PTSD really fits. And I also don't think that BPD should be sort of given the stigma of vilifying it, of like, this is a bad one to have.
Well, right. And I also think that like it does sort of like demonize the person with right. that. And that isn't accurate. And we know that. And if you're listening to us, I hope you know that. But I think one of the things that gets people to sort of like fit into one of those camps is that we view antisocial personality disorders or narcissistic or borderline or anything like that as like either you were born like that or it's your fault sort of thing. Mm-hmm. In contrast with PTSD being somebody did that to you or right. something happened to you, which is why. So you were one way beforehand, an event happened or several events happened right. and now it's left you like this, and why I think it gets that sort of empathy card.
Right.
So much more so than all of the others, because there isn't like a before and after this
yeah.
kind of thing. And I think that that's where a lot of that comes from. And so it's really easy to like demonize something that you can't really understand the onset of, or right. like maybe it was always there, or you can't really pinpoint, you know, a before and after thing. Whereas like,
right. Or like, look, you were this sympathetic person we all liked right before this thing happened. And now you're tough to get along with.
Right.
Where like, nobody with mental health chooses to have mental health.
No.
Not one person I know was like, let me look at the book, point my finger. I want that one. Like, it's not a fucking catalog, you know?
Right. And it's not a buffet where you're like, I'll have a little of this and not that. And no, none for me, please, today.
Right.
But I do think that, like, while PTSD often, not always, and sometimes not enough, is given a little bit more grace, the room isn't always left for the others, though I think we still have a lot of growing to do with PTSD, no doubt.
Right.
I think depends where you look and what you're focusing on, but we don't do enough for that either. So,
well, and
jot that down.
Jotting. I think it's hard too when you get this different response from different people in the courtroom, because like it's damaging for so many reasons, and obviously it doesn't give the individual the attention, care, or help that they very clearly need.
Mm-hmm.
But also they're struggling. In fact, research shows specifically with BPD that something like 70% of people diagnosed with it will attempt to take their own life. 70%.
That hurts my heart.
That's almost 3 out of 4. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, that's a lot of people. And it's not funny. It's not cute. And it's not something to use as a way to vilify someone else. And I know that that is not like the active intention, but I think by misdiagnosing for the sake of an argument, it gives that undertone.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, wrapping that up with a nice little bow, if I had to pick one, I'm picking BPD.
Mm-hmm.
And if I really had to choose one, it's unspecified cluster B personality disorder, coming soon to a DSM-6 near you, hopefully. Now, for the sake of ending today and keeping it nice and neat, the interrogation wasn't entirely over after she got arrested, because they arrest her and then the next day they try the female detective and that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, bring me back Detective Flores, and they bring him back and she says, okay, I lied. I didn't do it, but I know who did.
Oh.
And that's where we're going to end for part two.
Oh, Abigail. Dude.
Dude.
You suck.
Sorry.
No, that's... Oh, my God.
What a case. You see why I couldn't fit this in two?
Yeah, no, I do. I do. And I think, just for you listening, because someone's going to be mad. Someone's always mad. We bring levity into these cases.
Yes.
Because otherwise we would be sobbing. This is an awful case. It's awful for Travis. It is awful for those that loved him. It's awful for those that love Jody.
Yeah.
I think parts of this were tough for Jody.
Yeah.
But I cannot stand by or condone so much of what she actively chose to do.
Oh, yes. I think if, like most things, if it had been an honest mistake, it was something earnestly that happened that she wasn't planning on, that wasn't okay, or even that she planned on and realized was a mistake, if you can just fucking own up to it and say like, oh shit, I'm in deep, like something happened, that's one thing. But the games we're playing here are an entirely different thing. Diagnosis aside, mental health aside, like hurt and rejection from a relationship failed aside, like this is a life. Like a human life. You gotta own up to that shit. Like, that's big.
And it was brutal. And I think that we're gonna talk a lot next week, I'm sure. As if, you guys, I don't get these notes. I don't get what Abby's reading. Like, I'm going off memory. I did not do the research on this one. And I very much love an Abby hyperfixation. It's one of my favorite things in the world. And I also love that we get to sit here and do that with you all, because I think you guys like it too. But Travis's whole reputation is slandered.
Oh, yeah. 100%. That's her entire point.
Because he was killed by her. He was denied the opportunity to grow and change and settle down or do whatever it was that he wanted. Because while he was not perfect to Jody, Jody was certainly not perfect to him. And he was the only one, I think, acknowledging that they weren't right for each other.
Yeah.
And so he was wrapping it up and moving on. And she was entirely incapable of doing that, obviously.
Obviously.
But, you know, a lot of what I am sure we're going to cover in the trial is just prefacing it to say it's fucking awful.
It's awful. And it's something that I wish we didn't have to talk about because it feels like it perpetuates her narrative of it. Frankly, I believe very little of her narrative of it. There are parts that seem to hold merit, but the vast majority and the main points of her argument feel very baseless.
A lot of it seems very surface level, that if you just scratched it away a little bit, you would see that it was bullshit.
Yeah.
But I think that there was so much else going on with just the sensationalism of this case, because this was no joke.
No. No, not at all. It was a 5-month trial.
Absolute madness. Can you imagine getting picked for jury duty and you're like, all right, here's a week.
Oh my God.
But to be on the jury. To be on
that jury. To be on that jury and to be like, yeah, so today's the day we have to listen to phone sex for jury duty. What the hell?
And phone sex they had to listen to.
And poop shoots they had to see.
They sure did. Did you say a leather Cheeto? I swear to God, that is still living in my head.
That was from Reddit. All right, you guys. Well, please, if you are interested in the people, the places, the things that we're talking about, butthole aside, we're probably not posting that anywhere.
Definitely not posting that anywhere.
Clearly, I don't do the Instagram, but you can find that on our Instagram. It's linked in our link tree below, along with any other way to support the pod, whether that's merch, seeing our Instagram, our email, our little PayPal and Venmo is in there. You could also down below see those sources like mentioned before. And if you wanted to, in the meantime, also send us like pictures of your pod pets again, because like I'm seriously in the need for some photos of some cute little pets, some dogs, some cats, some snakes, bunnies, etc. I'd love to see your fur family, you know. You could send those over, as well as any recommendations or hometown cases that you're interested in. But until next time, if I look at my clock, that was...
About time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye.